Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Labor Beat Radio Show here, broadcast on Enlighten Radio. You can access us at www.enlightenradio.org. That's sort of the blog site, but we also have, and the player is usually on the top of the page. Oh, hold on.
Once the getting was good, but now the getting's got gone. So I'm going down.
We'll call that our lyrical introduction there. Anyway, and so the podcasts that I usually put up the same day as we record the show are at podcasts.enlightenradio.org. And the player, standalone player, is at player.enlightenradio.org. And we're broadcasting. We changed the time here to 9 o'clock in the morning to help out with those people from the Midwest that were having to get up at 6 o'clock before, and that was a little too much. Anyway, I want to. My name is John Case, and our hosts here are J.B. Christensen and Scott Marshall. J.B. and I are from the Eastern Panhandle of West Virginia. J.B.'s the president of the CLC, and we're not, you know, we're probably one of the smaller CLCs in the state, but nonetheless, we're called one of the most active. So, and JB has a lot to do with that. And I want to welcome as a special guest this morning Steve Nopke, a friend of mine from way back, and he is working in Ford as we speak. Well, not today. Has been a longtime member of the UAW. And I think he's active in his local committee. Is that correct, Steve?
Yep.
Yep. And 28 years, did you say, on the job?
Just about, yeah. Just shade over.
Shade over, anyway. And so, and he's also a serious student of the auto workers' history, as well as labor history in general. And so I hope that he can open up with us this morning and give us some background to what is obviously a very historic moment for auto workers for a lot of different reasons, I'm sure Steve will go into a little bit. And at the same time, I see in the news media that what is going to happen in auto is very much on the agenda or attention, anyway, of the President of the United States, at least according to CNN. And it's also high on the agenda for CNN. So anyway, welcome to the program, Steve. And helps out, you know. What's the big deal in auto coming up here?
Well, thanks a lot, John, for inviting me here. Yeah, I'm on vacation. This is a 2-week shutdown. Traditionally, in the UAW, you have a shutdown at some point. Where it used to be model changeover, they call it, but now it's just a shutdown. So I do have today off. I guess let me just start with the kind of thing you opened up with in terms of negotiations, and then I'll get into a little bit brief history. Negotiations are beginning this week, I think Thursday, Friday, and then sometime next week, the 18th is when GM starts. Traditionally, you always have these pictures of Walter Reuther and then everybody since them leaning over, shaking hands with the president or the CEO of whatever company. Well, that's not going to take place this year. What Sean Fain is doing is he's holding a membership handshake. So he's going out to the Michigan Assembly Plant in Wayne, Michigan, and then they're going to a Stellantis and a GM place, and they're going to handshake with the members. And then they're going back to negotiations. And according to Sean, they'll shake when they got a deal. They're not going to shake hands ahead of time. And I think although this is symbolic, I think it's what they're trying to convey to the membership, that this is a new way, this is a new leadership, that we're not going to do things the same way. So as negotiations begin, there's really three principal issues, three big issues. And one of them is the ending of the tiers. So that, you know, the companies back in 2008, 2009, actually a little bit earlier in some cases, they were able to get a two-tier system where people, new hires, were getting less money. And that was done when the companies were in trouble. I mean, there was a shake up of the industry. There was a lot of bankruptcy. There was plants closing. So union agreed. And at the time, because I was at the meetings, the big, large meetings where the union officials were saying, hey, this is temporary. but on temporary turned into permanent. And I think that there was not enough attention to the damage that was done by these two tiers. And so now it's kind of catching up with us. And you can have, I couldn't begin to tell you the different numbers of people, the different wages that different people are earning. So I was sitting at a break table the other day, there's four of us, and we all four of us had a different wage rate. And that's the huge problem. And so that eliminating of tiers is probably the number one issue that's going to be placed with. And as if there's some type of settlement, we'll have to see what it is. But that the idea that you can be paid different wages and it takes you 8 years to get to full pay is unacceptable. And you know, there's a large turnover in the union, and people are coming to work making $16.70, $16.75 an hour. And you know, Sean Fain was in Ohio, Lordstown area, and he said, he at press conference afterward, he says, you know, these folks in these bad new battery plants, they start off at $16.70 an hour. You go down to Waffle House, make $18 an hour. You don't have to work so hard. Because you know, these jobs are difficult jobs. You know, there's a high turnover rate because you're standing on assembly lines. So, and you know, newest workers get the worst job. So the question of tiers is number one. 1A or whatever, the top three is also includes COLA. We gave up COLA, cost of living adjustment, back in, I think it was 2009, and never got it back. And so the gap between what we are making, what we should be making, and what the cost of living has been is huge. And so the idea of reestablishing COLA is an important one. Now, what the last contracts have had was a $1,500 COLA bonus in July. Well, you know, you get $900 from that because of that. And it just doesn't keep up. And the thing is with COLA, you get the COLA, and then every negotiations, you turn that into the wages. So you start over again. So if you got a COLA of about $1 an hour, well, that gets turned back into your wages as up your wages by $1 an hour. And then you start over again on COLA. So that's how you kind of permanently keep your wages reflecting, you know, what the cost of living is. And obviously one of the issues is what gets thrown in COLA, you know, housing costs, energy costs. I mean, if you just, you know, how the COLA is determined is an important issue also. So that's the second thing. The third is job protection. And that covers a couple different areas. Obviously, with the developments of the, you know, electrical vehicles, there's going to be a change in industry. I work at an engine plant, and you know, we're not going to be getting rid of gasoline engines, you know, for a long, long time. But there is going to be a turnover. You're already seeing it in some of the truck plants. For example, in the Rouge plant, they're dropping one shift from the traditional gasoline engines to and transferring those people over to the electrical vehicles. So they're already seeing that, you know, take place. And the big issue is that all the parts and the, you know, batteries are the everyone knows, but there's also a lot of other parts involved in making these automobiles related to electrical vehicles. And so, for example, you're going to do away with transmissions. You're going to do away with exhaust systems, you're going to do away with the engines and replace them with a different type of powertrain. And that's all it is. It's you drive, you know, the powertrain is either gasoline or it's electric, but it's the same damn thing. And the union's position now is that powertrain belongs in the master contract. And that's going to be a huge fight, is to protect the the wages of all workers, to get to protect their wages and their you know, working conditions. So you have these electrical vehicle plants then that I have to be organized, and many of them are very low wage. And I think that's what the issue was with when Sean Fain, the UAW president, went to Washington and announced he wasn't going to endorse Biden right away, because they want guarantees from the federal government that all this tax money that went into these electrical vehicle plants, we're glad they're there, but that's our members paid for that money. That's part of our members pay those taxes. We pay pretty decent taxes if we're working in the auto industry, and we want fairness in that. And so what we don't want is to the government to say, yeah, just throw up their hands and we don't care what the wages are. We want some pressure to make sure that these wages are and benefits are in line with good union jobs. And I think essentially he's calling out Biden, saying, you want to be the most pro-union president, you got to take a stand on this one. In all honesty, you know, it's a little controversial, but a lot of workers are still pissed off about what went with the railroad workers. And the fact is that there's, no matter you slice it, he did not involve himself on the side of the workers. He played it safe and whatever. And people got that in their mind. I think that's kind of the initiative between why the union's saying, hey, you know, we want some support on this one. So that's what the negotiations are. Let me stop there. I can go into the history a little bit more later, but let me stop talking for a minute and see if there's any questions or comments.
JB's having a problem. He's been trying to talk, but he's not being heard. I don't know what's going on, but he did ask a question. He wants to ask.
I had a problem when I was married.
Yeah. Well, he's asking a different question. He's saying, why don't they try? What's the UAW doing to organize Tesla? JB is driving a Tesla, by the way. I just want you to know that. So he has a vested interest.
Well, first of all, there have been efforts to organize, and there was two or three different efforts. One, they've gone there. The difficulty with a Tesla is that it's extremely skilled workforce there, and that's who they're bringing in. Now, the UAW made a couple efforts at the Tesla plant in California is what it was, but in building the new one in Texas, they were trying to get salts into that place. So there's been an effort, but, you know, you're talking about, you know, really, you know, this is old-fashioned robber baron. I mean, he'll do anything to keep the union out, and so it's a huge fight. So I think what the union is doing right now is they're going to focus on organizing the battery plants and the other transplants. As far as Tesla is concerned, my kid's wife owns one. They wanted to go on a trip to – they were going to go to Acadia Forest in Maine. They live in Wisconsin. And he said they got to rent a car because that Tesla has to stop every 2 hours to recharge. And it would add about 7 hours to their trip. So good luck on going far in your Tesla.
Well, it's getting – you know, yeah. Scott, go ahead. By the way, do you know how much the Tesla workers make compared to their other plants, even though it's a different level of skilled work?
They're paid decently, from what I've been told. So I don't know the specifics, but okay. I just know that it's a really tough nut to crack.
All right, Scott, yeah.
Yeah, I have a question about, and Steve and I have talked about this before, but I want to get it on the air too. I want to talk about the automation that's taking place and robotics in the auto industry and the impact that's having. I think probably most of us know that, I think it's in Japan, they have an assembly line that makes an entire car from parts to coming off the assembly line fully painted, and it's all done by robots. It's totally robotic. And that's also having a huge impact on the workforce, in the sense that one of the apprenticeships that is going through the roof is robot care. And people, they see that as part of the future. So I'm just wondering how all of that impact goes in. And by the way, I also have an electric car, and I love it. But the problem is there are not enough charging stations. So hopefully that's developing. But anyway, and obviously getting away from fossil fuels is pretty important for the planet, too. But anyway.
What about hybrids, Steve? Is Ford making do they make a hybrid?
Yeah, they make hybrids in let's see. The Maverick is a hybrid. When they had the Fusion and the Focus, Fusion for sure was a hybrid. That was my sister has a hybrid. She loved it. She gets 64 miles to the gallon on that one. And you know,
Fusion too.
Yeah, and first, she never went a mile over the speed limit, so she was a real pain in the ass to drive with. But if you want to keep your mileage down, that's one of the ways. You just drive with my sister. But the point is that, yeah, these things are out there. And in terms of the technology, that's true. And that's always going to be a case. The robotics are just another form of automation. And it's a continuing. To give you an example, when I first started at Ford a while ago, on a crankshaft line, you machine crankshafts, and you would before I got there, the generation of equipment that made those crankshafts would have about 60 to 65 people per line, because everything that was done to that crankshaft in terms of the milling, the drilling, et cetera, that had to be done pretty much by individuals on individual machines. Well, then they got to transfer machines, where a machine, it would a transfer line would pick it up, transfer it over, and it was done more automatically. And that had about 20 people to the line. So the next generation now is more of a lot of the CNC machines, which is computer numerator control. And there now there's down to about 11 people per line. And that's all because of the changing technology. And that's always been the case. And you know, that, you know, if you ever get a chance to go to Detroit and go to the Rivera museums, you'll see pictures of those assembly lines. And it was just shoulder to shoulder to shoulder. Right. And so that's changed. And that's, everybody knows that's part of the change. And the truth is, some of it's not so bad. A buddy of mine worked in a foundry in Cleveland. This is a long time ago, 40 years ago. And he worked in the knockout house. So that the foundry was producing, engines, engine blocks, iron engine blocks. And they come out of the last stop, they come out and they went to the knockout house, and they take 35 pound sledgehammers and bang away on these to knock the carbon out. And you worked 20 minutes on, 40 minutes off, but that 20 minutes was absolute hell.
Wow.
So that was all done manually. And so these things are changing, and most workers understand that change. I don't know about the completely automated, you know, Japan's a little bit of a different deal over there, but I don't, you know, but there are sections in, if you go look at the paint shops, for example, there used to be a lot of, or even a better example was you used to go to with the welding, a lot of the welding of the bodies. You know, if you ever had kids that had them little toys that they're the transformer toys, you know, how they switch them around. If you go into a section of road, it looks exactly like a bunch of goddamn 30-foot transformers, because they're things move all quickly, and they do all that, and they do all that. And have a couple people technicians. Now, they also can, you got to be very careful, because I had a friend of mine that thought he had the thing locked out, got whacked in the head, and he had to quit because he lost all memory from about 30 years ago. You know, he just hit him. So they're very dangerous. But they are effective, and that's the process that's taking place. So you don't have as much of the individual welding on the bodies like you used to have. You have a little touch-up welding. So all that is true, Scotty. There is that robotic change, but I don't think that's going to eliminate, certainly not in the United States, auto workers. It's just going to make us more productive is what it is. And so, that's why this whole demand is around new work. And every time you have something like that, well, you know, you do. You have to repair. You have to repair those robots, but you also have to make them. Yeah. So there's also all kinds of opportunities, and that's what the union is saying. Anything related to building parts that go into a car, that's our work. Yeah. And we want a union. Right. We want it well paid, because the companies have made enormous profits, enormous profits. And in the town hall meetings that Sean Fain has done, he's talked about the fact there's one simple answer. It's corporate greed. You know, they publicize the wages or the wages of the salaries of the top guys is 28, 29 million. And that doesn't include bonuses. They fired a guy from Ford a few years ago. They gave him a $35 million buyout. What the hell?
You know, I'll take it.
If you have inside information, you know, it's worth paying off to avoid embarrassment, maybe, you know, that. So
he was an idiot. He didn't have the inside information. What's he going to, you know, there is no, you know, they don't have any technology that somebody doesn't have already. You know, it's just their way of taking care of their own. And
I have another question. With all these new battery plants being built and all these new factories being built, well, what's the union strategy in terms of organizing those?
Well, I don't know the specifics of it. I do know that they're going to have an approach to the states that they're building them in. For example, Michigan's got three or four of them. So you've got a friendly governor. I think that I've seen a map where there may be as many as 40 or 50 different plants from around the country. I could be wrong on that, because I saw it real quickly. This may just be possibility.
Oh, I think you're right.
But these are all over the country.
Right.
A lot of them are now, you know, if you're in Virginia and your governor says he doesn't want the Chinese Communist Party in his backyard, then you kick him out. okay, fine. Michigan said, you know, bring it on. We're not too worried about those guys. They're gonna. So that's what you're dealing with. So, and most of these, some of these are going in traditional areas, and some of them are in states and parts of the country that are not are not traditionally pro-union. The thing about it is that you look at Kentucky, they're getting a couple of these plants in Tennessee. Kentucky is all of a sudden becoming a real hotbed of union activity because you got big auto plants down there. They used to call that the I-75 corridor that go from Michigan down all the way through. So that's changing the way people are thinking in that state. You keep on adding those industrial workers, and they bring, it doesn't take too long for them to develop an industrial worker mindset. And then the UPS in Louisville, it's the biggest air hub in the country. There's a lot going on. So these plants are going all over, but I also think it'll have an effect on how these things, and there is going to be an active effort to organize every single plant.
That's great.
And I know the AFL-CIO is going to assist in this too. They've already started some of these projects.
Let me ask a question. If you completely automate a factory, where does the profit come from? I don't think there is any. Now, if you're a company, you're going to buy all these machines and robots, okay? Whoever makes them is going to make the profit on that, okay? You're not going to make any profit on that. Not on the average anyway. You might get a killing 1 week and lose the next week, but all that stuff that comes in, all those inputs to production, you don't make any money. You don't really make money on those unless you get lucky some week. Okay. Reliably, you make money on the stuff that's created with those tools. Okay. By human hands. I just don't see where the profit comes. If it's fully automated, the Japanese company you're talking about, Scotty, how do they make money? Unless they're the only one and they can charge a higher price, just, there's no competition at all. Is that what's going on? I don't quite understand.
Well, the way I look at it is that they've just spread out the exploitation to these smaller and smaller groups out that, make the robots and do all those things. That's where the profit comes from, that exploitation.
Yeah.
Do they own? Yeah, what's the name of the company that makes that has that plant? Is it one of the?
I don't know. I don't know.
Is one of them like Toyota or the big one, or is it just some small guy that came up with this idea?
I think it's a big one, but I really don't know. I'll try to find it.
Take a huge investment to completely automate everything. I mean, that would cost a lot of money. On the question of the upcoming struggle, though. You mentioned that historically there's been this pattern bargaining tendency, not only the handshake, but a whole orderly way of handling negotiations in the industry. That seems to have also fallen off the truck here. And another sign that it's heading toward a collision, right? What's the strike preparations like? Is your local involved getting ready? Just waiting to see what happens, or what's the mood in the shop?
Well, to start with, on the question of pattern, just for your listeners, traditionally what the UAW would do is they pick one company, decide which was the best one to get the best contract they could get, and then try and get that pattern to the other three companies. That was, so if they never went with everybody on once. So if there was a strike, it would be a strike at one company. As you saw last year, or 4 years ago, the General Motors strike. So that isn't being talked about. And there's nothing official, and all you hear is little buzzes around, but what you don't hear is a long, this time of year, everybody would be kind of standing in line to try to, they wanted to be the pattern. Ford wanted to be a pattern, GM, they all wanted to be the pattern. You're not hearing that now. So I do think it's a very possibility that they're going to abandon the pattern. Now the strike preparations are this. At the last convention, a bunch of stuff that went on, the strike pay was up to $500 a week. So I was out at a picket line for these small workers the other day, and they were getting $500 a week. And they said, this allows us to hold on as long as we can hold on. So they were able to settle that strike after about about a month, maybe 5 weeks. You saw the same thing in the ag imp industry with John Deere and with Case. They were able to hold out for quite a long time. And then when it came to Caterpillar, at the last minute, they were ready to go on strike, and they blinked and said, all right, let's come up with a deal. So they came up with a pretty good deal. So the preparations, in all honesty, part of the strike preparations is the fact that the union was willing to strike on these ag imps and really prepare for it. So what's going on the local level is, in terms of my local, they're already looking at strike kitchens, how to set it up. There's going to be, when we get back, will be discussions about picket captains and a lot of informal stuff about, all right, you're going to do this, you're going to do that. But there will be elections for this stuff and preparation. So the preparations have begun. The other set of preparations, and I can speak pretty much for my local, historically, we've had a great relationship with our community. You know, we live in Dearborn, and you have the Arab community, you have the Southwest Michigan. There's dozens and dozens of projects. Every month you come to the General Council meeting, which is the governing body of the local, and there's always, they're asking for $500, $1,000 here, and for all kinds of different community groups that we sponsor in the schools and that kind of stuff. So we have a great relationship with the community in our area. And the nice thing about it is when we go to eat, we're going to have a wide variety of food coming our way. I don't know if you've ever been in a strike kitchen. I mean, when I was on strike with the Teamsters, our strike kitchen consisted of two barrels, you know, with two fire barrels and guys bringing in cooked meats. That was it. You know, that was our strike kitchen.
That's like a Brazilian restaurant.
I expect that there's going to be a lot of strike support in the community if we have to go out. So we've already, every local has been giving their, been the process. I don't know what every local, how they do it, but the captains are going to be selected. There's going to be strike kitchens put together. Community support is already there. So those are the preparations we're doing. Now, the other thing that's being promised about these negotiations is they're going to be much more open, so that there'll be strike bulletins, or, you know, bulletins coming out, negotiation bulletins. If we're on strike, you know, tell them more information about what's going on. When GM went on strike last time, there was no word for nothing. You didn't hear anything. And you got to remember, the GM strike took place under the cloud of the president about ready to get his ass thrown in jail. Mm-hmm. And so there was all kinds of stuff going on. He was a complete idiot, and it doesn't speak well for us that he was elected or selected. I'm going to put it that way.
Yeah.
That's different now. And I think that, the way the old system worked with the caucus, basically they were more responsible to the caucus than they were the membership. This election, which is one member, one vote, very clearly they see this, the incumbents, the people that are elected now, see themselves directly responsible to the union for this. So that's how the strike preparations are taking place. That's kind of give an idea of what's going on. I think we'll be ready. And there's an enthusiasm for the union on this part. In the shop floor, you know, there's always going to be, this guy's this and this guy's that. That's always going to take place. But what I think you're seeing is the coming together of people saying, we got to take the company on. This is our best chance. Because who knows what's going to happen 4 years down the line. But these guys are making the boatload of money. We know it. You know, screw it. This is our time. So there will be a huge fight. If the companies, and I think the Secretary Treasurer, Margaret Mock, said it very clearly. She said, don't ask us about a strike. Right? Ask the company, because they got the money. It's clear. You can't hide it. They got stacks of money sitting all over the place. They're making $28, $29 million a year. Don't tell us you don't have the money. We made our sacrifices. Now it's time for you to make the sacrifice. So I thought her answer on that was really crystal clear, right. And I think that's the one we're going with.
Hey, JB just had a comment here. He said he's very impressed with your strike preparations, and the strike kitchen is new to him. Of course, he's from the Marine Engineers. He was on the Merchant Marine for years, you know. So he says it sounds incredible to him.
just on that, on strike kitchens, it just reminded me when I was in the United Glass and Ceramic Workers in Nashville, we had a strike, and we had a strike, sort of a strike kitchen. They set up a couple tents down at the picket line and stuff. But what was really interesting about that was how many groups from the neighborhood brought food in. And they would stand, they would stay there and talk to us about the strike and why we were striking and why they're supported. But one of the really interesting things for me from that was that that was the first time I was ever exposed to certain kinds of Chinese food. And one of the things that they brought that I just love and still love to this day is hot and sour soup. It's just a wonderful, wonderful soup. And I was introduced to it at a strike.
There you go. That's right, man. You
can get that kind of community involvement is critical nowadays for strikes and for supporting the unions.
We had the chief steward's wife. I went on a strike at Greenfield Tap and Dye in Greenfield, Mass. You know, one time she brought duck's blood soup, a Polish soup, right? You know, to the picket line, and people were going to turn it down. Of course, everyone was pretty, they weren't going to turn any food down, really. They were going to complain a little bit, but everybody loved it. I mean, it was like, it's a very tasteful soup. It's just the name kind of turns you off a little bit. But, you know.
Vampire soup.
The hungrier you get, the more you'll eat.
Yeah,
that's right. One other question. So the Dearborn City Council, government, your state reps, do your community relations, do you have decent relations with these people? How are they going to land if people get in trouble?
Well, we got, in terms of our local, Dearborn is, the mayor has been to the local a number of times. We helped get him elected. And, it's like in Dearborn, you throw a stone, you're going to hit somebody that's related to the auto industry. And I don't know whether it's his father or whatever, but he's got connections to Ford and the UAW. There, we have one of the top leaders of the state Senate who led the fight to repeal the right to work. His father's a tool and die guy out of our local. So Cameron, he's been at our local a number of times. And, and there's a lot of these people that, feathers, grandfathers, grandmothers, whatever. They're, you go to a political meeting and everybody's going to talk about how their father, their uncle, whatever, their grandmother, their mother, how they are affected by the UAW. So with the political leaders, there's a huge number of them that are be supportive. And I have no problem saying that, there'll be a lot of political support in the state of Michigan because, we're very active. And the head of the Michigan AFL-CIO is Ron Bieber, whose father was president of the UAW for a number of years, Owen Bieber.
Yeah.
And so these kinds of connections are there for us. And, we're in the process of making, talking to these people, but that we'll have people are going to be lining up get their pictures on our picket line.
All right. Well, we're at about the 40 minute point here, which I usually don't, people don't usually listen to, podcast too much beyond that level. By the way, JB, I said great show, Steve. We would love to have you back again when the strike develops in the months to come. Anyway, absolutely. So I think that's great. I was going to give you the opportunity to take us out a little bit. That would bring us right in at the about 40 minutes. Okay. If you could, what does this mean? And there's a rebellion going on, not just in the auto workers, but across the country. We've been talking about the truck drivers. There's a whole huge movement among hospitality workers in Los Angeles. The longshore and other aspects of trucking have been in trouble a lot. And you can just see almost every state council has somebody that's on strike or getting ready to go on strike. And so how does this, are we looking at a historic upsurge, in working class, in the working class movements? Maybe it's going on so intense in your neighborhood that it's hard to step back and even reflect upon it yet. But do you have any, take us out and help us gut.
I guess the two things I want to say. One is I think historically in the UAW, we've had a delegated system. And for a lot of different reasons, we had one member, one vote. And I think that, and the Teamsters have the same thing. I think that kind of ability for the rank and file to have a more direct say in their union leadership is what's led, I think, to this kind of more militancy. But I do think it's a product of the capitalist system. I mean, the screws are being tightened. everywhere you're seeing more, you know, all kinds of efforts to reap profits from people by just working them harder, changing their work schedules, all these kinds of things. And I think workers are done. And I think there's enough leadership that's coming forward in the Teamsters and the UAW and in Unite Here, in the Longshoremen. I think you're seeing a that kind of melding together of rank and file anger and pissed off, and leadership that's saying, you're right, we got to fight. And I think it's kind of a coming together. And I've been, you know, I got 28 years in the UAW. I got 11 years as a Teamster. I was an organizer for hospital workers for 4 years. And so I've been on my share of strikes. I've thrown my share of rocks at cars and all that kind of shit. What you're seeing now, though, is the militancy that is sticking together. I mean, you know, I laugh about the stuff with rocks and cars, and, you know, you get pissed off. But the real ability to win a strike has nothing to do with that kind of shit. It has to do with sticking together. And, you know, I can remember being younger and doing stupid shit and someone saying, hey, Steve, you know, act like an adult here, brother. And that, I think, is what you're seeing. I think you're seeing a maturity of the rank and file movement coming together, saying we're going to stick together, we're going to fight. And I think you're seeing the leadership saying, yes, we're going to fight with you, as opposed to trying to sell a contract. The first strike, yeah, I was on, all they did was sell the contract. They never showed up. No, there's no support. When you guys are ready to come back to work, let us know. Well, shit, you know.
Yeah.
That's not what's happening. You're seeing a united effort among leadership as well. But it's that, to me, in my opinion, this is my whatever, that's what you're seeing. You're seeing a coming together of the rank and file militancy and activism, young workers in Starbucks and Amazon, ooh, young workers in auto and mm-hmm, Teamster and hotel. All these younger workers are coming in, and they know that their future is not nearly as guaranteed as their fathers and mothers and their grandfathers and their grandmothers. My daughter told me the same thing. She said, Dad, you know, I kind of joking about my generation, you know, we kind of left you with a bunch of shit. She goes, well, that's why we got to fight for our stuff.
That's right. And,
you know, we got to fight. You either die or you fight. And I think you're seeing this generation kind of inspiring other people. So that's pretty much my take on it is that you see the rank and file, a maturity in the rank and file and the leadership. And you're seeing more and more people being inspired by this idea. You got to fight. You got to fight.
I love your take on how to run a strike. You know, I remember the first time we had a bunch of camera. They made camera lenses and near Boston. They walked out on strike. They got mad at the boss for a whole bunch of reasons. And then, you know, my great mentor, Don Tormey, shows up at the picket line. And they ask him, well, what do we do? He says, the same thing you do in any strike. You know, you find something for everybody to do, and you don't ever leave anybody behind.
Yep.
You know, yep. And that was just and by the way, I would start picketing unless you walk the scabs across. So that was a wonderful interview. Thank you so much, Steve. And I guess, and JB's just, right. He says he's falling in love with you. Go ahead.
Just one other quick thought. You know, the role of the labor movement and the overall struggles in this country is growing all the time. And the way that they're making, that the whole labor movement, the AFL-CIO, is making all of these alliances with the women's movement, with the Black Lives Matter, with all of these different movements and the young workers, is just an incredible strength that's coming through in the labor movement. And I think that's something that we have to help build, all of us.
You know, they had the anniversary of the March on Washington coming up. And in Detroit is where Martin Luther King first made his I Have a Dream speech. Right. So last weekend, the 24th, they held a commemoration march. And that, you know, Sean Fain spoke at that. They had and I think he's made a really big effort to reach out and talk about these different groupings and as coalition, as partners in the fight, is basically where they talk about it. So okay. It's developing.
All right. Okay. Well, I think we're at the 40-minute level here, and I want to thank you guys for Steve for showing up. I know you're normally not available at this hour, but going down
normally,
the road.
I'm on my third cup of coffee.
Yeah. So, but you know, we can
start at 5. So by 9 o'clock. through the day.
We can always tape.
We'll send you some coffee next time.
Yeah, and
all right, we got the best coffee pot.
We email coffee all the time.
And we can
tape
a show.
Run the coffee. They run the coffee place. So the pipe fitters are great coffee makers.
And plus, if you're on strike, you'll be able to call in. I mean, it's not your time. Be a little bit. You'll have a little bit different schedule. You know, maybe. So in any event, we can also tape at night at some time if you want to do an update. I don't think that's some.
Glad to. All right, everybody.
Thanks, and we'll be back next week. By the way, next week so we have a representative from the Physicians for National Healthcare, that a doctor actually who wants to come on and explain or understand what the relationship of the labor movement is to, you know, universal healthcare and what's going on. So, and I guess we'll have a conversation with him about that. All right, everybody, take care of each other. It's late, but everything comes next. Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Recording stopped.